Street, and a pair of equally famous traitors. Coriolanus, with his contemporary, the glamorous but unreliable Athenian, Alcibiades. Modern historians have tended to break up the pairs and to read them as individual life stories. That is to miss Plutarch's point entirely. These were not just biographies. They were a concerted attempt to evaluate the great men, and they were all men, of Greece and Rome against each other, to think about the relative strengths and weaknesses of the two cultures, and about what it meant to be Greek or Roman. They were nicely ambivalent, putting the Roman subjects into the same league as the ancient Greek heroes and, to see it from the other perspective, making the characters from the ancient Greek past comparable to those who then ruled the world. In a way, this was the fulfilment of a project sketched out 250 years earlier by Polybius, who, as a Greek hostage in Rome and friend of the Scipios, had been the first to attempt that cross-cultural political anthropology of Rome and its empire, and to try to explain systematically why Greece had lost to Rome. Free movement. The cultural interaction that defined the Roman Empire was not something that took place only within people's heads, whether humble potters or ancient theorists, and it was not merely a matter of different local accommodations to the power of Rome, although that was an important part of it. There were also massive movements of peoples and goods across the empire, which intensified this cultural diversity, while bringing enormous profits to some and making victims out of others. This was a world in which people could, as never before on this scale, make their homes, their fortunes, or their graves thousands of miles away from where they were born, in which the population of Rome relied on basic food grown at the edges of the empire, and in which trade distributed new tastes, smells, and luxuries, spices, ivory, amber, and silks, from one end of the Mediterranean to the other and beyond, and not only to the super-rich. Among the precious possessions of a fairly ordinary house in Pompeii was a delicate ivory figurine made in India, and a document from Vindolanda showing that quantities of pepper from the Far East were being sold to the garrison there. The routes into Italy from the rest of the empire were an important axis of this movement. Everything that Rome wanted was sucked into the metropolis. People were one of those commodities. Packed as the city was, the human death rate from malaria and infections, as well as the other regular dangers to ancient life, meant that there was always the room and the need for more. Some of them were slaves, picked up in the war, or now, more likely, the victims of an unsavoury trade of people trafficking that made the margins of the Roman world a dangerous place to live. Others must have migrated to the city with hopes and aspirations, or out of desperation. Their stories are largely lost to us. But the short epitaph of a young man called Menophilos, who died in Rome, had come from Asia and was skilled in music. "I never uttered offensive words, and I was a friend of the Muses," hints at the innocent ambitions of some of those who thought that the streets of the capital were paved with gold. The natural products of the empire, its luxuries and curiosities, also flooded to Rome, and signalled the city's status as an imperial power. Balsam trees of Judea were paraded in the triumphal procession of 71 CE. Exotic animals captured in Africa, from lions to ostriches, were slaughtered in the arena. Luscious coloured marbles, quarried in remote locations across the Roman world, decorated the theatres, temples and palaces in the capital. The images of trampled barbarians were not the only things to stand for Roman domination. So too did the colours of the floors on which the Romans walked in the grandest buildings of their city. These stones amounted to an assertion, and a map, of empire. They also hint at the enormous effort, time and money that the emperors were prepared to devote to displaying their control over their distant possessions. To take just one example, Supporting the porch of the Emperor Hadrian's Pantheon, finished in the 120 CE, were 12 columns, each 40 Roman feet high, roughly 12 metres, and carved from a single block of Egyptian grey granite. This is not to modern eyes a spectacular material, but it was an extremely prestigious stone used in many imperial projects, partly because it was found only in one faraway place, 2,500 miles from Rome, Mons Claudianus, the Mountain of Claudius, named after the emperor who first sponsored work there, in the middle of the eastern Egyptian desert. It was only with immense difficulty and a huge investment of labour and cash that columns of this size could be quarried and transported to Rome in one piece. Excavations at Mons Claudianus over the past 30 years have revealed a military base, small villages for the quarry workers, and a supply and transport centre. And they have turned up many hundreds of written documents, often scratched on recycled broken pieces of pottery, a workable alternative to wax tablets, that give a hint of the organisation and its problems. The provision of food and drink was only the first. There was a complicated supply chain of everything from wine to cucumbers, which did not always work. "Please send me 2 loaves of bread, for no grain has come up here for me so far," reads one begging letter. And water was rationed. One document is a water distribution list that numbers 917 people working in the quarries. The work was laborious. Every one of the Pantheon columns would have taken 3 men well over a year to hack out and trim down, and occasionally, as some of the documents attest, a half-prepared monolith would crack, and they would have to start again. Transport was the next hurdle, especially as the quarries were almost 100 miles from the Nile. One letter on papyrus from Mons Claudianus begs a local official to send grain supplies, as the quarries had a column of 50 Roman feet, weight 100 tons, ready to go, but the food for the pack animals to get it to the river was running out. Even in the case of the Pantheon, it is clear that not everything went to plan. Some slightly awkward design features of the finished building make it seem likely that Hadrian's architects had banked on getting 12 50-foot columns, but had to adjust at the last minute when 12 40-foot columns were all that the quarry could provide. The stone transport from Mons Claudianus is an unusual case of the movement of goods around the Roman world. It was largely in the hands of the imperial administration, backed up by soldiers, and is hard not to suspect that it was intended in part as a display of Rome's ability to pull off the virtually impossible, a reductio ad absurdum of Roman power. But in many other markets, from absolute staples to more affordable luxuries, trade and profits boomed in the empire. Vivid snapshots survive of men who struck it very lucky in all sorts of commercial enterprise. One papyrus of the mid-second century CE lists the goods with their cash value, which came on a single ship from southern India to Egypt, presumably destined for Rome. It was worth, after tax, more than 6 million sesterces, the equivalent of a decent senatorial estate in Italy at the time. Pliny had bought a large but slightly run-down property plus land for 3 million. And the cargo included 100 or so pairs of elephant tusks, boxes of oils and spices, and very likely vast quantities of pepper. A man called Flavius Zeuxis was not quite in that league, but his epitaph, found in the ancient textile town of Hierapolis, in what is now southern Turkey, boasts that over his career he made 72 journeys around Cape Malea, at the southern tip of the Peloponnese, on his way to Rome to sell his fabric. It is not clear whether his 72 trips were single or return voyages, but either way, this was a lifetime's achievement worth parading. Beyond these individual entrepreneurs, the bigger picture is revealed in the much less glamorous, but even more impressive facts and figures of basic supply. A little hill on the banks of the River Tiber in Rome, now known as Monte Testaccio, Broken Pot Mountain, conjures up better than anything else the scale of the trade in staple foodstuffs that kept the million people who lived in the city alive, and the network of transport facilities, shipping, warehousing and retailing required to sustain it. Despite its appearance, that is not a natural hill at all, but the remains of a man-made Roman rubbish dump, the broken fragments of 53 million containers of olive oil, pottery amphorae, with a capacity of about 60 litres each. These had almost all been imported from southern Spain over 100 years or so, from the mid-second to the mid-third century CE, and had been dumped as soon as the oil was decanted. This was one part of an enormous export trade that changed the economy of that part of Spain into an agricultural monoculture, nothing but olives and more olives, and delivered to the city of Rome just some of what it needed to survive. At a rough estimate, the basic requirement amounted to 20 million litres of olive oil per year for lighting and cleaning, as well as cooking, 100 million litres of wine and 250 tons of grain. Almost all of this came to Rome from outside Italy. The mobility of empire, however, was not restricted to the axis between the metropolitan centre and the rest of the Roman world. One of the main developments in the empire of the first two centuries CE was that it became a territory through, around, and within which people moved, often bypassing Rome. The traffic did not simply flow between centre and periphery. There are many ways of tracking this movement. The most up-to-date involves looking at the evidence of human skeletons, particularly their mouths, in ever more precise ways. Modern scientific analysis has shown how the distinctive imprint of the climate, water supply and diet of the growing child leaves traces in the teeth of the adult, giving hints about where any particular dead person grew up. The studies are still very provisional, but they seem to show that a substantial proportion of the urban population of, for example, Roman Britain, grew up in a different climatic region from the one in which they died. Whether that was the warm south coast of Britain versus the chilly north or the balmy south of France is so far hard to tell. Some of those journeys can be traced in the stories of the people who ended up near Hadrian's Wall. The picture often conjured up of a miserable bunch of soldiers from sunny Italy being forced to endure the fog, frost and rain of northern Britain is very misleading. The garrison was largely made up of forces recruited in equally foggy places across the English Channel, in what are now Holland, Belgium and Germany. But at all levels of the wall community, individuals came from much further afield, even from the opposite ends of the empire. These range from Victor, an ex-slave of a cavalry officer, whose tombstone identifies him as a Moor, to one of the grandest Romans in the province, Quintus Lollius Urbicus, the governor of Britain between 139 and 142 CE. Thanks to some lucky survivals, we can still identify both the building work he sponsored in northern Britain and the family tomb he commissioned at the other end of the Roman world, in his hometown of Tiddes, as it is now called, in northern Algeria. Most evocative of all is the story of a man from Palmyra in Syria, Barates, who was working near Hadrian's Wall in the 2nd century CE. It is not known what brought him the 4,000 miles across the world, probably the longest journey of anyone in this book. It may have been trade, or he may have had some connection with the army, but he settled in Britain long enough to marry Regina Queenie, a British woman and ex-slave. When she died at the age of 30, Barates commemorated her with a tombstone near the Roman fort of Ribea. Arbea, modern South Shields. This depicts Queenie, who, as the epitaph makes clear, was born and bred just north of London. as if she were a stately Palmyrene matron, and underneath the Latin text, Barates had her name inscribed in the Aramaic language of his homeland. It is a memorial which nicely sums up the movement of peoples and the cultural mix that defined the Roman Empire and raises even more tantalizing questions. Who did Queenie think she was? Would she have recognized herself as that Palmyrene lady? And what would this couple have thought about the Rome in whose world they lived? They create desolation and call it peace. There was certainly some strong opposition to aspects of Roman rule. Integration, mobility, luxuries, and commercial profit were only one side of the story of the empire. The other side included disobedience and tax dodging, passive resistance, and popular protests, often aimed as much at the local elites as at the Romans. But open armed rebellion against Roman occupation seems to have been rare over the first 2 centuries CE. Some brave, though ultimately always doomed rebels against the invincible power of Rome have become the legendary heroes and heroines of modern nations, whether Herman the German or Boudicca, whose regal bronze statue stands proudly outside the Houses of Parliament on the banks of the River Thames. And the fortress of Masada, where in 73 CE, 960 Jewish rebels opted for suicide rather than submission at the end of a long siege, is now an Israeli national monument. But these are the exceptions. The Roman Empire does not appear to have been an empire of insurrection. That impression may be slightly misleading. Roman authorities, like many modern states, had a vested interest in writing off principled political rebellion as if it were treachery, riot, or simple crime. It is impossible to know the aspirations of the so-called bandits who troubled Roman governors in many parts of the world, or to pinpoint where exactly the boundary lay between highway robbery and ideological dissidence. And when the Jews in Jerusalem took to violence in the reign of Claudius after a Roman soldier exposed himself in the temple, was that just a riot? Or should it be seen as the spark of an incipient rebellion quashed by the Roman authorities in the province at the cost of thousands of Jewish lives? Besides, emperors, hungry for military glory, could find it convenient to represent the suppression of internal insurrection as if it were external conquest in the old tradition. The arch erected to commemorate the triumph of Vespasian and Titus over the Jews in 71 CE, before the final Roman victory at Masada, offers no clue that the victory was against armed internal rebels, not a foreign foe. The rebellions that we know about were not the work of high-principled or narrow-minded nationalists. Getting rid of the Romans was never the same as an independence movement in the modern sense. Nor were they driven by an excluded underclass or religious zealotry. Religion often confirmed the aspirations of the rebels and provided unifying rituals and symbols, from the messianic hopes of the Jews to the human sacrifices reputedly carried out by Arminius in the Teutoburg forest. But rebellions were not specifically religious uprisings. They were usually led by the provincial aristocracy, and were a sign that the relationship of collusion between the local elites and the Roman authorities had broken down. To put it another way, they were the price the Romans paid for their dependence on collaboration. Rebellions were usually sparked by some isolated inflammatory or offensive act on the part of the Romans which upset the delicate balance of power. The Jewish revolt, which began in 66 CE, stemmed largely from divisions in the ruling class in Judea and the mutual distrust between them and the Roman authorities. The governor's order to flog and crucify a number of Jews in the province, who were also Roman citizens, was one powerful provocation. Most of the best-known rebel leaders in other parts of the world had very close connections with the Roman administration. Arminius, who massacred Varus's legions in 9 CE, and Julius Civilis, who led another German rebellion in 69 and 70 CE, were both Roman citizens and ex-soldiers in the Roman army, as well as being members of the local aristocracy. Even the uprising of Boudica in Britain in 60 CE fits this pattern. Boudica, or Boudica, we do not know exactly how to spell the name, but neither, presumably, did she, was not an inveterate enemy of Rome, but part of a family of elite collaborators. She was the widow of Prasutagus, a leader of the Britons in eastern England and a Roman ally, a Tiberius Claudius Togidubnus, on a more modest scale. On his death, he left half his tribal kingdom to the emperor and half to his daughters, a sensible division intended to ensure peaceful continuity. In this case, according to Roman writers, it was the behaviour of some Romans in taking possession of the bequest that was the spark to the rebellion. They moved in with determined or heedless brutality. Soldiers plundered the property of Prasutagus, raped his daughters, and flogged his widow. In reaction, Boudica raised her supporters and went on the attack. As usual in these rebellions, short-term success on the part of the insurgents and terror on the part of the Romans was followed, sooner or later, by a resounding Roman victory. Boudica's militia instantly destroyed three Roman towns in the new province, burning them to the ground and cruelly killing the inhabitants. One Roman historian, mingling fantasy, one hopes, with misogyny and patriotism, refers to Boudica's soldiers hanging up the enemy women, cutting off their breasts, and sewing them into the victims' mouths to make them look as if they were eating them. But as soon as the news reached the governor of the province, who was fighting 250 miles away in Wales, he marched straight back and wiped out the British insurgents. Tacitus gives a boastful but highly implausible figure of 80,000 British casualties, as against just 400 Romans. Boudica took poison and, according to one tall story, lies buried somewhere near Platform 10 of King's Cross Railway Station in North London. What Boudica's aims were, we can only guess. Her true story is clouded by ancient and modern myth-making. For Roman writers, she was a figure simultaneously of horror and of fascination. A warrior queen intersects barbarian Cleopatra, very tall in stature, with a manly physique, piercing eyes and harsh voice, and a mass of red hair falling to her hips, as she was described centuries later by someone who could not possibly have known what she looked like. In Britain, over the past few centuries, she has not only been turned into a national heroine, on the optimistic assumption that her more unsavoury aspects were Roman propaganda, she has also been reinvented as the ancestor of the British Empire that one day outstripped ancient Rome. Regens Caesar never knew, thy posterity shall sway, is the message carved on the plinth of her statue by the Thames. Empire too, even bigger empire. No word from Boudica or from any of the other rebels has come down to us. The closest we have to such a perspective are the multi-volume Jewish histories by Josephus, the one-time insurgent against the Romans, who wrote his self-serving account of the rebellion that ended in the siege of Masada, from the comfort of his study in Rome. Whether as traitor, asylum seeker, or far-sighted politician, he had taken up residence there under the protection of the Emperor Vespasian. But that is a very special and very partial case. The histories of Tacitus and other Roman writers do feature long speeches from many of the most prominent opponents of Roman rule. In them, Boudica denounces the immoral luxuries of Roman civilization and the effeminacy of the Romans, while lamenting the lost libertas of the Britons, a loss symbolised by the rape of her daughters and her own flogging. Julius Civilis in Germany rouses his followers by comparing Roman rule to slavery rather than alliance, and lists the unfair exactions imposed by the imperial power. Most memorably of all, in Tacitus's biography of his father-in-law, one of Rome's enemies, as part of a set-piece speech delivered before he enters battle with Agricola, challenges Roman rule and what it adds up to. The Romans, he insists, are the robbers of the world, insatiable for domination and profit. And in a much-quoted phrase that still hits home, he sums up the Roman imperial project. They create desolation and call it peace. Solitudinem faciunt pacem appellant. These local rebels almost certainly did not utter any such fine phrases on the eve of battle, and the Roman historians who coined them could not possibly have known what was said on those occasions in any case, and would have dreaded the thought of living under a Boudicca. But they knew exactly what the political objections to Roman rule might be and how to express it. While we must regret not being able to read the authentic views of the provincial dissidents of the empire, the idea that Roman writers could imagine what it was like to be in opposition to their own imperial power is perhaps even more important, and it is a distinguishing feature of Roman culture and power. At the end of the 1st century BCE, the historian Sallust, looking back, saw Rome's destruction of Carthage and Corinth in 146 BCE as a turning point towards Roman decadence, and could try to reconstruct some of King Jugurtha's views of the Romans as power-hungry, corrupt, and irrationally opposed to monarchy. A century or so later, Tacitus and others imagined in vivid detail what the script of those provincials who rebelled against Rome might be. No one has ever framed a better critique of Roman imperial power than the words put into the mouths of rebels against Rome by Roman writers themselves. Christian Troubles. The problems with understanding the conflicts between the ancient Romans and the troublesome Christians are the exact opposite. The victory of Christianity, which in the 4th century CE became the official religion of the Roman Empire, ensured that there is an enormous amount of surviving evidence, argument and self-justification from Christian Roman writers, and almost nothing from their traditional pagan Roman opponents outlining their objections to the new religion. The letters between Pliny and Trajan amount to one of the most loquacious non-Christian discussions of the new religion to survive. The Christian texts of the 3rd, 4th and 5th centuries CE are some of the most extreme examples ever of the rewriting of history to fit the agenda of the winners. They construct a triumphalist history of Christianity as victorious, both against its pagan rivals, despite cruel persecution by the Roman state, and against all the internal variants, heresies, as later Christians defined them, which challenged what came to be Christian orthodoxy. The truth is that for 2 centuries after the crucifixion of Jesus, sometime in the early 30s CE, Christianity is hard to pin down. It started as a radical Jewish sect, but how and when it became clearly separated from Judaism is impossible to say. It is not even certain when Christians started regularly to use that name for themselves. It may originally have been a nickname applied by outsiders. They were for many years small in number. The best estimate is that by 200 CE there were about 200,000 Christians in the Roman Empire of between 50 and 60 million people, though they may have been more visible than the figure suggests, as they were overwhelmingly concentrated in towns. The word pagan was their term for anyone who was not a Christian or a Jew, and it implied anything from outsider to rustic. And they held a whole variety of views and beliefs about the nature of God and of Jesus, and about the basic tenets of Christian faith that were gradually, and with great difficulty, pared down to the range of Christian orthodoxies, still not a single one, that we know today. Was Jesus married with children? What exactly happened at the crucifixion? Did he die or not? Many wondered, not unreasonably. From time to time in the first 2 centuries CE, Roman authorities punished the Christians. There was at this period no general or systematic persecution. There was no sign of that until the mid-third century CE. In practice, most of the early generations of Christians lived untroubled by the intervention of the state, yet they were occasionally scapegoated, as when Nero decided to shift the blame for the Great Fire of Rome in 64 CE onto them. They were plausible candidates, perhaps, as some Christians were prophesying that the world would shortly end in flames. The letters between Pliny and Trajan suggest that there was some Roman legislation that, whether explicitly or implicitly, outlawed the religion, though we know no more than that. Pliny's uncertainty and puzzlement are reflected on some other occasions when Romans chose to punish Christians in different parts of the empire, from Gaul to Africa. One particularly revealing moment is described in the account of her own trial by a Christian woman who was sent to be killed by wild beasts in the amphitheatre in Roman Carthage in 203 CE. Vibia Perpetua, a newly converted Christian, was aged about 22, married and with a young baby, when she was arrested and brought before the procurator of the province, who was acting in place of the governor who had recently died. Her memoir is the most lengthy personal and intimate account by a woman of her own experiences to have survived from the whole of the ancient world, dwelling on her anxieties about her child and the dreams that she experienced in prison before she was sent to the beasts. Even in this account, the frustration of her interrogator comes across, and his keenness to get her to recant. "Have pity on the white hairs of your father. Have pity on your tiny baby," he urges her. "Just make a sacrifice for the well-being of the emperor." "I will not do so," she replied. "Are you a Christian?" he asked, now putting the formal question. When she said she was, Christiania sum, she was sentenced to death. The procurator was obviously baffled, and so it seems was the crowd who watched her die in the amphitheatre. Roman blood sports obeyed a rather strict set of rules. It was animals and criminals and the slave underclass who met their deaths, not young mothers. In fact, the crowd shuddered at the sight when they saw that Perpetua's fellow martyr, Felicitas, had breasts dripping milk. So why on earth were the Romans doing this? Whatever the letter of the law or the precise circumstances of any individual trial, there was an irreconcilable clash between traditional Roman values and Christianity. Roman religion was not only polytheistic, but treated foreign gods much as it treated foreign peoples, by incorporation. As far back as the takeover of Veii in the early 4th century BCE, Rome had regularly welcomed the gods of the conquered. There were, from time to time, controversies and anxieties about this. The priests of the Egyptian goddess Isis found themselves expelled from the city of Rome on more than one occasion. But the basic rule was that as the Roman Empire expanded, so did its pantheon of deities. Christianity was, in theory, an exclusive monotheism, which rejected the gods who for centuries had guaranteed the success of Rome. In practice, for every Perpetua who went bravely, or in Roman eyes stubbornly, to her death, there were probably hundreds of ordinary Christians who chose to sacrifice to the traditional gods, cross their fingers, and ask for forgiveness later. But on paper, there could be no accommodation. The same was true in a sense of Judaism, but to a remarkable and in some ways unexpected degree, the Jews managed to operate within the Roman culture. For the Romans, Christianity was far worse. First, it had no ancestral home. In their ordered religious geography, Romans expected deities to be from somewhere. Isis from Egypt, Mithras from Persia, the Jewish god from Judea. The Christian god was rootless, claimed to be universal, and sought more adherence. All kinds of mystical moments of enlightenment might attract new worshippers to, say, the religion of Isis, But Christianity was defined entirely by a process of spiritual conversion that was utterly new. What is more, some Christians were preaching values that threatened to overturn some of the most fundamental Greco-Roman assumptions about the nature of the world and of the people within it. That poverty, for example, was good, or that the body was to be tamed or rejected rather than cared for. All these factors helped to explain the worries, confusion, and hostility of Pliny and others like him. At the same time, the success of Christianity was rooted in the Roman Empire, in its territorial extent, in the mobility that it promoted, in its towns and its cultural mix. From Pliny's Bithynia to Perpetua's Carthage, Christianity spread from its small-scale origins in Judea, largely because of the channels of communication across the Mediterranean world that the Roman Empire had opened up, and because of the movement through those channels of people, goods, books, and ideas. The irony is that the only religion that the Romans ever attempted to eradicate was the one whose success their empire made possible, and which grew up entirely within the Roman world. Citizens. So was Christianity really a Roman religion? Yes and no, for it obviously depends on what we mean by Roman. A malleable and elusive adjective that can be used in many senses, from political control to style of art, from place to period of time. The right answer to the question of how many Romans lived in Roman Britain could well be about 5. If we mean only those born and bred in Rome, it could equally be around 50,000, if every single soldier, plus the small staff of the imperial administration, including slaves, are all deemed to count. It would be more like 3 million if we reckoned that all the inhabitants of the Roman province were now, in a way, Roman, even though most of them, outside the towns, would probably not have known where in the world Rome was, and would have had no more direct contact with Roman powers than the occasional bit of loose change in their pockets. One important definition still rested in Roman citizenship. For an increasingly large number of the inhabitants of the empire, becoming Roman meant becoming a Roman citizen. Throughout the provinces in the first 2 centuries CE, there were many ways in which this happened. Non-citizens who served in the Roman army were made citizens when they completed their term of service. Local officials in towns across the empire were more or less automatically granted Roman citizenship. Whole communities or individuals, like Tiberius Claudius Togidabnus, were made citizens for special services they had rendered. And slaves of Roman citizens, wherever they lived, became Roman citizens if and when they were freed. There were none of the tests or examinations that we have come to associate with acquiring citizenship. No saluting the flag, swearing loyalty, or paying a fee. Citizenship was a gift. And by 200 CE, according to the best recent estimate, roughly 20% of the free population had become citizens. To put it another way, there were probably at least 10 million provincial Roman citizens. Citizenship brought with it all kinds of specific rights under Roman law, covering a wide range of topics from contracts to punishments. The simple reason that, in the 60s CE, St. Peter was crucified while St. Paul enjoyed the privilege of being beheaded was that Paul was a Roman citizen. For a few, citizenship was the first step in joining the elite of the central Roman government, on a journey that even led to the Senate and Imperial Palace. Several emperors in the 2nd century CE had origins outside Italy, from Trajan, whose family came from Spain, to Septimius Severus, who ruled between 193 and 211 CE and was the first emperor from Africa. More and more senators were also of provincial origin. They included Lollius Obicus, the governor of Britain from North Africa, Agricola, whose family came from southern Gaul, and many more who proudly displayed their achievements in the capital. the fifth man ever to enter the Senate from the whole of Asia, in inscriptions in their home towns. Some emperors promoted the trend. In his speech in 48 CE, which advocated admitting to the Senate men from northern Gaul, hairy Gaul, as the Romans called it, Claudius explicitly justified the proposal by looking back to Rome's openness to foreigners from its earliest days and forestalling one obvious objection. If anyone concentrates on the fact that the Gauls gave Julius Caesar, now a god, such trouble in war for 10 years, he should consider that they have also been loyal and trustworthy for 100 years since then. By the end of the 2nd century CE, more than 50% of the senators were from the provinces. They were not drawn evenly from different parts of the empire, none came from Britain, and some of them, like the first foreign emperors, may have been the descendants of earlier Italian settlers in the provinces, rather than native, but not all, or even most. In effect, the provincials were now ruling Rome. That does not mean the governing classes of Rome were part of some warm, liberal, cultural melting pot. In our terms, they were relatively race-blind. The reason that we can still debate the ethnic origins of the African emperor Septimius Severus is that ancient writers made no comment on them. But the Roman elite were certainly snobbish about senators from the provinces. People joked about them not being able to find their way to the Senate House. Even Septimius Severus is supposed to have been so embarrassed by his sister's bad Latin accent that he sent her back home. And Claudius's speech arguing in favour of admitting hairy Gauls to the Senate was prompted by widespread senatorial objections to the proposal. Yet, at least by the 2nd century CE, at the centre of the Roman world, were a substantial number of men and women who saw the empire from both sides, who had two homes, Roman and provincial, and who were culturally bilingual. Gaius Julius Zoilus. It is with the story of one of those bilinguals that we end this chapter. Gaius Julius Zoilus is not a familiar name. He was no Polybius, Scipio Barbatus, Cicero, or Pliny. He has left no writing, except a few words on stone, and is never once mentioned in the surviving literature of the Roman world. But different periods of Roman history are captured by different kinds of people. Zoilus, an ex-slave, imperial agent, and wealthy benefactor of his hometown, stands for many of the themes of the Roman Empire. At the same time, he is a powerful reminder of those many Roman life stories that are almost hidden from history and are still being pieced together. All we know about Zoilus has been revealed in excavations, mostly over the past 50 years, of the small Roman town of Aphrodisias in what is now southern Turkey, which must have been his original and final home. His elaborate tomb has been discovered there, which gives a glimpse of his appearance, though tantalizing, most of his face has not survived. He is mentioned in a letter from the future Emperor Augustus, written in 39 or 38 BCE, and inscribed on stone by Aphrodisians in their city centre. "You know how fond I am of my Zoilus," are the exact words. And building projects that Zoilus sponsored in the town, from a new stage at the theatre to a major restoration of the main temple, blazoned his name as benefactor and philanthropist. From all these, it is possible to reconstruct the outline of his career. He was almost certainly born free, just plain Zoilus, sometime in the first half of the 1st century BCE, but was taken into slavery, likely by pirates or people traffickers, but possibly as a prisoner of war in one of the many conflicts of the period. He ended up in Rome as a slave and agent of Julius Caesar, who gave him his freedom, and with it Roman citizenship and the Roman name of Gaius Julius Zoilus. He went on to work closely with the first Augustus, who knew him well enough to claim fondness before returning to his hometown as an extremely wealthy man, probably enriched by the booty from Caesar's campaigns, which trickled down even to slaves and ex-slaves. There he built himself into prominence in the traditional way, and at his death, probably sometime in the reign of Augustus, was given a monumental tomb at public expense. If an epitaph found in Rome to a son of Zoilus refers to his son, there were other men called Zoilus in the Roman world, then some of his family did not return to Aphrodisias with their father. For this, Tiberius Julius Papus, son of Zoilus, is commemorated as the head librarian of the emperor's libraries in the mid-first century CE through the reigns of Tiberius, Gaius, and Claudius. It is Zoilus's tomb at Aphrodisias that captures the culture of empire best. A vast square pile decorated with an elaborate sculptured frieze around its base, which even in the fragments that survive features Zoilus more than once in crucially different guises. On the best preserved side of the monument were two images of the dead man, clearly named, being crowned. On the left he is being honoured by the very Roman figures of Virtus with her shield and Onos, manly heroism or prestige. On the right it is the turn of his local people and his city. But it is the difference between the two outfits of Zoilus that are the key. On the left, he is dressed in a distinctively Roman toga. One arm is raised as if to address an audience, and in the other hand, he probably held a scroll. On the right, he is shown in a Greek cloak or chlamys, with a characteristically Greek hat on his head. The monument underlines Zoilus's success, his wealth, his social mobility, and his mobility across the Roman world. But most of all, it shows him creating his identity in two very different forms, here seen side by side. In the culture of the Roman Empire, it was possible to be both Greek and Roman. Epilogue. The First Roman Millennium. In 212 CE, the Emperor Caracalla decreed that all the free inhabitants of the Roman Empire, wherever they lived, from Scotland to Syria, were Roman citizens. It was a revolutionary decision which removed at a stroke the legal difference between the rulers and the ruled, and the culmination of a process that had been going on for almost a millennium. More than 30 million provincials became legally Roman overnight. This was one of the biggest single grants of citizenship, if not the biggest, in the history of the world. For centuries, defeated enemies had become Romans. Slaves had been granted Roman citizenship at the same time as their freedom. And, as time went on, provincials in vast numbers, both soldiers and civilians, were made citizens as a reward for loyalty, service, and collaboration. This was not entirely without controversy or conflict. Not all of those who were given citizenship wanted it. Some Romans did not conceal their suspicion of outsiders, citizens or not. "I can't bear a city full of Greeks," as the satirist Juvenal voices the complaint. And the desire of some of Rome's Italian allies to gain the citizenship from which they felt excluded partly drove one of the bloodiest wars in Roman history, the so-called Social War in the early 1st century BCE. But the underlying pattern is clear. Caracalla, in 212 CE, completed a process that in Roman myth Romulus had started 1,000 years earlier. That is, according to the conventional date, in 753 BCE. Rome's founding father had been able to establish his new city only by offering citizenship to all comers, by turning foreigners into Romans. Why Caracalla chose to take this step at precisely this moment has puzzled historians ever since. He was the second ruler in a new dynasty that came to power after the assassination of Commodus on the 31st of December, 192 CE. In the first civil war at Rome since the brief conflict after the death of Nero in 68 CE, different units of the army, including the Praetorian Guard and legions in the provinces, attempted to install their own candidate on the throne. One of these was Lucius Septimius Severus, originally from Leptis Magna in North Africa, who marched into Italy backed by the army he had been commanding on the River Danube. His first years as emperor until 197 CE were spent eliminating the opposition. Caracalla was his son and heir, who ruled from 211 CE and was officially known as Marcus Aurelius Antoninus. For, in a ludicrous twist on the use of adoption in imperial succession and in a desperate gambit for legitimacy, Septimius Severus arranged for himself and his family to be retrospectively adopted by the long-dead emperor Marcus Aurelius. Caracalla was a nickname taken from the particular style of military cloak, Caracallus, that he often wore. Caracalla is not remembered as a far-sighted radical reformer. He is best known as the sponsor of the largest set of public baths then built in Rome, whose towering brick walls still provide the impressive backdrop for a summer open-air opera season. But that hardly hints at the bloodier aspects of his reign. This started in 211 CE with the murder of his younger brother and rival, Geta. In a tawdry replay of the fratricide that marked the origin of the city of Rome, Caracalla apparently engaged a posse of soldiers to finish the young man off as he cowered in his mother's arms. It ended when Caracalla was just 29 years old, in 217 CE, with the assassination by one of his bodyguard, who took advantage of a private moment when the emperor was relieving himself by the roadside to plunge the knife in. The commander of the Praetorian Guard at the time, Marcus Opellius Macrinus, followed him briefly onto the throne. Probably implicated in the assassination, Macrinus was the first Roman emperor who was not by birth a senator. This inglorious career of Caracalla has often suggested that there must have been sinister, or at least self-interested, motives behind the citizenship decree. Many historians, including Lucius Cassius Dio and Edward Gibbon, have suspected that it was prompted by a need to raise money, for these new citizens would automatically have become liable for Roman inheritance tax. If so, this was an extremely cumbersome way of going about it. There was no need to give citizenship to more than 30 million people if all you wanted to do was increase tax revenue. Whatever lay behind it, this decree changed the Roman world forever, and that is why my story of Rome closes here, at the end of the first Roman millennium. The big question that had guided politics and debate for centuries about the boundary between the Romans and those they ruled had been answered. After 1,000 years, Rome's citizenship project had been completed and a new era had begun. It was not an era of peaceful, multicultural equality, though, for no sooner had one barrier of privilege been removed than another was put up in its place, on very different terms. Citizenship, once granted to all, became irrelevant. Over the 3rd century CE, it was the distinction between the honestiores, literally the more honourable, the rich elite including veteran soldiers, and the humiliores, literally the lower sort, that came to matter and to divide Romans again into two groups with unequal rights formally written into Roman law. It was, for example, only honestiores who were exempt, as all citizens had once been, from particularly cruel or degrading punishments such as crucifixion or flogging. The lower sort of citizens found themselves liable to the kind of penalties that had previously been reserved for slaves and non-citizens. The new boundary between insiders and outsiders followed the line of wealth, class, and status. The citizenship decree was only one element in a wide series of transformations, disruptions, crises, and invasions that changed the Roman world beond recognition in the 3rd century CE. The second Roman millennium which did not finally end until Constantinople, the capital of the Roman Empire in the east by the 6th century CE, fell to the Ottoman Turks in 1453 CE, was grounded on entirely new principles, on a new world order and, for most of the time, on a different religion. The autocratic regime established by the first Augustus had been based in a political language and institutions that went back as far as anyone could trace in the first millennium of Roman history. And what I have called the Augustan template of imperial rule provided a relatively stable political framework for almost 200 years after Augustus's death in 14 CE. But if the Emperor Tiberius, who succeeded the first Augustus, could have slipped fairly comfortably into the imperial shoes of Commodus at the end of the 2nd century CE, he would not have understood what it was to be an emperor a few decades further on. Rome, in its second millennium, was effectively a new state, masquerading under an old name. Whether this millennium was one long, slow period of decline, a series of patchy cultural and political changes, which eventually transformed the ancient world into the medieval, or an extraordinarily dynamic era of art, architecture, and cultural reflection, depends on your point of view. The historians now often talk about the crisis of the 3rd century CE. What they mean is the process by which, after the assassination of Commodus in 192 CE, the Augustan template collapsed. The number of emperors is one obvious sign of that. In the nearly 180 years between 14 and 192 CE, apart from the single brief interlude of civil war after the death of Nero, when there were three unsuccessful claimants to the throne, there were just 14 emperors. In the 100 years between 193 and 293 CE, there were more than 70. The list is elastic, depending on how many unmemorable co-emperors, usurpers or pretenders you decide to include. But, more to the point, any attempts to keep the legions out of the process of making emperors dramatically failed. Almost all the men who claimed the throne in the middle of the 3rd century CE did so with the backing of one army unit or another. It was more or less continuous civil war, and there were flagrant subversions of traditional claims to power. For Septimius Severus to announce that he and his family had been adopted as heirs by an emperor who had died more than 10 years earlier strained even the most flexible Roman standards of adoption. At the same time, the city of Rome was eclipsed as the centre of power. Emperors were not often there, but hundreds of miles away with their armies. They did not have the time, incentive, or cash to follow the Augustan model of leaving their mark on the city in brick and marble, or of acting as popular benefactors. After the vast baths that Caracalla constructed in the 210 CE, there were hardly any major imperial building projects in the capital for 80 years, until the Emperor Diocletian built his even bigger set of public baths in the 290s, large parts of which still stand outside Rome's main railway station. The absence of emperors from Rome also hastened the decline of the Senate. There was no place for civilitas between emperors and senators, for delicate consultation, or even for walkouts and stubborn protests by high-minded and unrealistic senators, when the man on the throne was not in sight. Emperors increasingly ruled remotely, by decree or by letter, and without reference to the Senate. The elevation to the throne of Macrinus, who was not a senator, and more such emperors followed, was another sure indication that the Senate could be bypassed. What lay behind these changes, and what was cause and what was effect, remains fiercely debated. Invasions by more efficient and often substantially Romanized groups of barbarians from outside the empire played a part. So too did the effects of the widespread plague in the late 2nd century CE, which even on moderate estimates of its death toll must have seriously undermined Roman manpower. So too did the delicate balance of the Augustan template, with its failure to establish clear rules for succession, and its awkward compromises between emperor and senate. Once flouted, it crumbled. But whatever the causes, the new Rome that emerged from the crisis of the 3rd century CE was strikingly different from anything that we have been exploring in Rome's first millennium. The city of Rome irrevocably lost its place as the capital of the empire and fell to invaders on 3 occasions in the 5th century CE. For the first time since its sack by the Gauls 800 years earlier, the Roman world came to be controlled from regional capitals such as Ravenna and Constantinople, modern Istanbul. The western and eastern parts of the empire were governed separately, and after periods of coordinated persecution of the Christians in the later 3rd century CE, the universal empire decided to embrace the universal religion, or vice versa. The Emperor Constantine, the founder of the city of Constantinople in the early 4th century CE, was the first Roman emperor to formally convert to Christianity, baptized on his deathbed in 337 CE. Constantine did, in a way, follow the Augustan model of building himself into power, but what he built was churches. Not everything changed in this new Rome, and certainly not all at once. The population of the city, Christian or not, was still enjoying spectacles in the Colosseum, probably wild beast hunts rather than gladiators, until well into the 5th century CE, and emperors in Constantinople sponsored popular entertainments on the old model of benefaction, often in the form of chariot racing. But many of the political continuities were superficial or even misunderstood. As a gesture to tradition, Constantinople was given its own senate house, but it was a building for an institution that had become a fossil. When an admittedly rather muddled commentator tried to explain the name of this building in the 8th century CE, he decided that it must have been built by a man called Senatus. In the city of Rome, the best indication of the changed world is the arch erected in 315 CE in honour of the Emperor Constantine's victory over one of his internal rivals. It still stands, preserved because it was once built into a Renaissance fortress between the old Roman Forum and the great amphitheatre of the Colosseum. At first glance, it looks entirely traditional, harking back to the arches erected in honour of many military victories in Rome, and copied in imperial memorials ever since, from the Arc de Triomphe in Paris to the Wellington Arch at Hyde Park Corner in London. It is decorated with an array of scenes that celebrate Constantine's authority in an idiom familiar from the first 2 centuries of autocratic power in Rome. The emperor is shown doing battle against barbarian enemies, addressing his troops, pardoning captives, sacrificing to the traditional gods, being crowned by victory, and giving handouts to the people. All this could have been carved 150 years earlier. In fact, much of it was. Apart from a few modest panels, all these sculptures had been prized or hacked off earlier monuments that commemorated Trajan, Hadrian, and Marcus Aurelius. The faces of the original emperors were roughly recut in the likeness of Constantine, and the pieces were reassembled for display on the new arch. It was a costly and destructive exercise in nostalgia. For a few ancient onlookers, it may have succeeded in placing the new emperor in the illustrious tradition of the old. But more than anything, this careful refabrication points to the historical distance between the first millennium of ancient Rome, which is the subject of my SPQR, and Rome's second millennium, which is a story for another time, another book, and another writer. And so, to end. I have spent a good deal of the past 50 years of my life with these first millennium Romans, I have learnt their languages as well as I can. I have read a good deal of the literature they have left us. No one has read it all, and I have studied some of the hundreds of thousands of books and papers written over the centuries about them, from Machiavelli and Gibbon to Gore Vidal and beyond. I have tried to decipher the words they carved into stone, and I have dug them up, quite literally, on wet, windy, and unglamorous archaeological sites in Roman Britain. And I have wondered for a long time how best to tell Rome's story and how to explain why I think it matters. I have also been one of those 5 million people who each year queue to step inside the Colosseum. I have let my children be photographed there for a fee with the chancers who ply their trade dressed up as gladiators. I have bought them plastic gladiator helmets, and, turning a blind eye to the cruelties of the modern world, I have reassured them that we do not do anything as cruel as that now. For me, as much as for anyone else, the Romans are a subject not just of history and inquiry, but also of imagination and fantasy, horror and fun. I no longer think, as I once naively did, that we have much to learn directly from the Romans, or for that matter from the ancient Greeks, or from any other ancient civilization. We do not need to read of the difficulties of the Roman legions in Mesopotamia or against the Parthians to understand why modern military interventions in Western Asia might be ill-advised. I am not even certain that those generals who claim to follow the tactics of Julius Caesar really do so in more than their own imaginations. And attractive as some Roman approaches to citizenship may sound, as I have tried to explain them, it would be folly to imagine that they could be applied to our situation centuries later. Besides, the Romans were as divided about how they thought the world worked or should work as we are. There is no simple Roman model to follow. If only things were that easy. But I am more and more convinced that we have an enormous amount to learn as much about ourselves as about the past by engaging with the history of the Romans, their poetry and prose, their controversies and arguments. Western culture has a very varied inheritance. Happily, we are not the heirs of the classical past alone. Nevertheless, since the Renaissance at least, many of our most fundamental assumptions about power, citizenship, responsibility, political violence, empire, luxury and beauty have been formed and tested in dialogue with the Romans and their writing. We do not want to follow Cicero's example, but his clash with the bankrupt aristocrat or popular revolutionary with which I started this book still underlines our views of the rights of the citizen and still provides a language for political dissent. Quo usque tandem abutere, Catilina patientia nostra. The idea of desolation masquerading as peace, as Tacitus put into the mouths of Rome's British enemies, still echoes in modern critiques of imperialism. And the lurid vices that are attributed to the most memorable Roman emperors have always raised the question of where autocratic excess ends and a reign of terror begins. We do the Romans a disservice if we heroise them, as much as if we demonise them. But we do ourselves a disservice if we fail to take them seriously, and if we close our long conversation with them. This book, I hope, is not just a history of ancient Rome, but part of that conversation with its Senate and people. SPQR.
The End. We hope you have enjoyed this production of SPQR by Mary Beard, narrated by Phyllida Nash. Recorded Books offers a wide selection of bestsellers, classics, histories and more. So look for us at your public library or on download sites online. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.